Hello, everybody. My name is Josh Beiser, and welcome to our first episode of the Perceptive Podcast. I'm the owner of Game Wisdom, and joining me is my co-host, Kenneth Holm.
Hey, guys. I'm Ken. I am the site designer. Also, I am a game artist here in Philadelphia. I work for Smuggy Games, so hopefully I can give some insight into game art and game design.
Yep, that's right. Basically, the overall goal and message of Game Wisdom is provide a source for critical discussion and thinking on topics relating to game design and the game industry in general. Basically, this site was originally going to be just an upgrade from my original blog, but as we were going through it, I realized that there really weren't a lot of places available online that talk critically about game design. There's a lot of places that focus on, you know, game art, game music, or just basically game news. And hopefully with Game Wisdom, we'll be able to turn this into a great resource for enthusiasts and designers. Also, we're currently looking for anyone who's interested in writing a guest piece for the site or coming on and being a guest on our podcast. For either one, you can find ways to contact us on the site itself. All right, let's get going with some game news.
Wait, just to remind our guys, it's game-wisdom.com.
All right. And so game news for me this week, I wanted to talk about a recent Kickstarter. This is one done by Peter Molyneux. He was the lead designer and man behind the God game genre, with titles like Populous, Black and White, which was about basically you creating a world and fighting other characters using these amazing powers, like being able to raise and lower the land. And what he's up to is his Kickstarter is for Project Goddess, which he's doing with his new studio, which is called 22 Cans. And they are currently 9 days in, and they've raised just a little over £177,000.
By the way, when did he leave Lionshead? By the way, just so you guys know, he also created the Fable series, too. He's more popular for that of recent years.
You know? He left Lionshead a few years ago. Let's see.
What was the reason, though?
Well, I know they did get bought out by Microsoft in 2006.
And that's probably part of it. Mm-hmm. Probably a conflict. Especially because he's such an artiste.
Yeah, he's always been really good at, I guess, being enthusiastic about his game ideas. Personally, I'm really torn between Project Goddess, because on one hand, I would really love to see this game succeed, because there hasn't been a lot of games in the God game genre recently. But on the other hand, I've really been, I guess, I wouldn't say burned, but disappointed by his last few games. I tried the Fable series out, and it never really clicked with me, and I was immensely disappointed with the movies, which was a game, it was basically a simulator that allowed you to run a movie studio, and then you could also create, well, according to the tagline, you could create movies with it. But just like with a lot of his other big ideas, it never really, I guess, grew or gained traction. Just, there's that basic concept, and that was about it.
Well, that's like one of his biggest flaws, Peter Molyneux. I mean, he always overpromises and underdelivers. You're supposed to be the opposite. You're supposed to, you know, underpromise and overdeliver to make yourself look good. But he would always make these wild claims that his games would have like a real-time growing forest, generational things, like with their character work. It's just things that at that time were nearly impossible. And even now there's a lot of limitations of that probably aren't even possible with what he thinks he's claimed in the past with Fable 1 and Fable 2.
Mm-hmm. And then we saw how Fable 3 really degraded with the whole good evil choice, mm-hmm. money versus progress kind of thing.
Well, and I mean, you haven't played Fable 3, but in the game there's this big importance on gathering money. And you have to make tough choices between this or this with the limited funds you have. But you could, you know, instead of, in, like, it has to do with funding projects with your treasury. But the thing is that you have a treasury and then your own money. And in most RPGs, you have like a mountain of money. So all the choices could be done with both the treasury money and your money, and there would be no real consequence. That really broke the game, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. And Black and White also had issues with its overall focus. And if a lot of people remember, a lot of the early reviews for Black and White were very positive. The game was getting like 9s out of 10s. And it was discovered that most people only play like the first two levels of the game and then just wrote the review off of that. But as you got further in, the issues of basically raising the belief of your people became more of a chore and just broken. Like, one of my worst memories of the game was I was basically stuck. I couldn't build any more buildings or do any quests because my ring of influence wasn't big enough. So I had to spend like 10-15 minutes just throwing a boulder around to get everyone to believe in me more, just to get like those few more inches needed to unlock like the next tier of the level.
Just like real life.
Yeah.
That boulder's moving by itself. Oh god. Literally gods.
Yeah. And what is your news for the weekend?
Oh, so my news would be just the Wii U launch. A lot of interesting things that's being said. I guess they had a record, not a record sale, but they had 400,000 units sell in the first week alone, which is better than the Wii, which I believe is 375,000. So, you know, they're claiming to be a big success, and obviously there's going to be an issue with supply because, you know, I'm sure the demand is higher at the moment because it's a brand new console launch, and it's unique enough for people to pique their interest.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it's going to develop, because we've been talking, Kenneth and I, before the podcast about basically the Wii U's accessibility versus its capturing the core gamer demographic again. And one of the problems we've been seeing in terms of advertising is that once again, Nintendo is just downplaying their core demographic. Instead of focusing on casual games and the big "I'm not a gamer" commercials that I personally don't like, because it just seems that they're repeating the same mistakes that they did with the Wii by, you know, just screwing the core gamers.
You have to look at the other perspective, though. They're seeing sales from their casual base. That's what they decided to start targeting instead of their core. But they're also seeing how that's also a bad idea, because with casual gamers, anything can draw their attention away, you know, any sort of, like, even something as simple as a Farmville update would distract them, and then you would lose a lot of random sales. A core will always stick with you, and there is definitely a core still on Nintendo. People will buy anything with Mario on it.
Of course.
However, I mean, the core itself has shrunken down a good size, and that hardcore market has gone on to Sony and Microsoft.
Yeah, and the other issue is just how Nintendo really isn't even trying at all to even get some core gamers back.
Mm-hmm.
For example, my favorite Wii game, probably going to be one of my favorite games this year, was Xenoblade Chronicles. And for those who didn't follow the story, originally Xenoblade Chronicles was released in Japan. It received very high reviews from magazines like Famitsu, but Nintendo said that they weren't going to port this. So petitions and everything was done over here to finally convince them, and Nintendo finally relented, but they made it only available through Nintendo's site or exclusively through GameStop. And to make matters worse, there were zero advertisements for Xenoblade Chronicles. I didn't see one TV ad, one print, not even like a simple ad on a website for the game. And it turned out to be one of the best games for the Wii. And it just is shocking to me how Nintendo just let this one just fly right past them.
Oh yeah, I mean, I believe that it's called Project Rainfall, was the term. They brought over Lost Story, they brought over Xenoblades, and I think they even brought over a Fire Emblem game also. So, they obviously was trying to show that, hey, Nintendo, we have a demand. You have these great games. Bring them over. We'll buy them. So, obviously, they couldn't ignore that. So that's one great thing, that we actually have those localized versions.
Mm-hmm, true. Now, what do you think about Microsoft and Sony's plans? As we know, after the Wii came out, Microsoft and Sony released the Kinect and PlayStation Move to basically get in on the same motion casual audience.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious that they're going, that Kinect has become one of the main tenets mm-hmm. of Microsoft, at least in terms of 360. And they're obviously going to make a Kinect 2, something with a lot more fidelity, with a lot more control, with a lot faster connections, because, you know, right now it uses, what, USB 2? There's almost so much data it can come through the camera, and that's a great limitation to the Kinect. So I'm sure, assume the next one would have, you know, mm-hmm. a better type of file transfer wire. I mean, it could be USB 3 or more. Some other thing that they might implement into their system. Obviously, we don't know the specs to the 720. Is that what it's going to be called?
That's the rumor, but who knows, really.
I always love the other cool names. I believe, like, when I was, remember the, back in the days of Sega, the Sega Saturn, no, Sega Saturn or the Dreamcast, I think the Dreamcast was going to be called Black Katana. Oh, no, and the second Saturn was supposed to be called Dolphin. That was their code names for, like, a long time, and then they just switched them. But I would have loved a Sega Black Katana.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Or a Sega Dolphin. Way cool names.
That will really help, I think, during the console wars, too.
Well, yeah, now they're just numbers. Now we have the PS4, and then, you know, the 720. It's absurd. But whatever. It's their own naming convention.
Now, the Wii U has gotten some negative press over the two packages that were released. There was the $300 model and then the $350 model. And from what we've been looking at, the big difference, one, is the $350 model comes with a larger hard drive. And what makes it so important is that people have been reporting that when you first hook up the Wii U and go online, it basically uses up, I believe, 3 or 5 gigs of space. Of, I think the $300 model is, I think, like a 9 or 10 gig drive to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really showing that the $350 model is, you know, the safe bet. And I think this is sort of similar to what I think Microsoft did a few times with the Xbox 360 packages. I think they had like the family bundle, the standard bundle, and there's like the hardcore bundle or like the gamer bundle.
Well, I'm just looking at the numbers right now. Mm-hmm. And it looks like, yeah, there's only two bundles, right?
Yeah.
At least from what I'm seeing. But still, a lot of people are up in arms with the cost in compared to the price of the Wii when it came out. It was $250. Mm-hmm. And they're complaining that its capabilities is equivalent to 360 and the PS3, which is this current gen or last gen. You know what I mean? It should be, if it's going to be a next gen system, it should also have next gen graphics. And
true.
Costing at this amount and this higher cost, they want to see that kind of fidelity comes with it.
Yeah. And that's going to be a big deal when we officially hit the next generation. And what's going to happen is Nintendo's going to once again probably be back in third place, because the 720 and the PS4 are obviously going to be more powerful than it.
Yeah, and Microsoft will use the Surface and, I mean, and Glass to do exactly the same thing that the Wii U does with its little controller. Because what they'll do is they'll install software to people's iPads or tablets to do exactly the same thing, control the thing from your tablet to your computer, to your game system.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be what's going to happen, and they're going to take that market that way.
Mm-hmm.
Sony's probably going to do exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And what that means for gamers is that once again, it's going to be that the only games you're going to really want to play on the Wii U are games that are specifically designed for it. But for the multi-platform titles, it's going to be a safer bet for the other consoles instead.
Right, exactly. And if not everyone's going to have a tablet, but their assumption is it's going to, I believe the rate is ever increasing every year of tablet acceptance. So I'm sure at some point they'll be using it to their advantage, these other systems, to just completely block off Nintendo and be like, all right, now we have everything you have. And obviously that allows companies and developers to produce games for all three systems again.
Mm-hmm.
But also I was reading some news on, some bad news on the Wii U launch. I believe Iwata came out and said that he's sorry that they released a system where all the features aren't available yet on launch. And he feels that that's unacceptable. Because like the Wii U TV does not work yet, and a bunch of other ones do not work yet. So they're just sitting there.
That sucks.
Yeah.
And Nintendo really doesn't need any negative issues with the Wii U right now, especially when they're just so close after Black Friday and with Christmas coming up. They don't really need as much positive buzz about it for right now.
And also for their investors are angry too, because they're taking a loss for the last quarter. So, I mean, it's one of the first in company's history.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe that's because they abandoned the core gamer.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens with these casuals, they bought it to be a Wii Sports machine. That's it. And now, then it grew a stigma for being a child system.
Yeah.
So you're lowering your demographic again in that aspect.
Yeah, and the games that did come to the Wii, the more mature titles, they are always, you know, inferior to the PS3 and 360 counterparts.
Right, and don't forget, it became a minigame simulator. Not minigame simulator, but just a bunch of worthless games came out that were just minigame packages that became really popular. Just developers were like, all right, just dump this, we'll make some money. Carnival Games, here we go.
Yeah, they're just a lot of just shovelware titles for the Wii. I saw, you know, like Hannah Montana games, a lot of like just movie license titles, stuff that got like twos and threes in a lot of game reviews, and really just oversaturated the market. But most developers and publishers didn't care because they were trying to basically tap the casual gold mine, as it were.
Well, that gold mine slips away very easily. What they need to do is build back their core, and they're trying to do that, because if you look at the Wii U games, some of them are pretty adult and pretty, especially they have Black Ops 2 for it. They also have Ninja Gaiden 3, and the reason I say Ninja Gaiden 3, even though that wasn't such a great game, they actually brought back the decapitation and gore for that game. What?
Yeah, a violence on Nintendo system that doesn't sound right.
Right, and it's weird because the other ones don't have that. And that's why it sucked real bad. So I'm sure they just took in the information saying, what do they hate about our game? Well, it was super simple and, you know, there's no gore, there's no decapitation. Like, we'll put in the Wii U on. And that's what happened.
And I have been hearing some positive things about Zombie U.
I've heard not a negative to Zombie U. Specifically on when you just have your cricket back, it takes like 8 hits to kill a zombie. And it becomes a chore.
You have a lot.
You tunnel in and you hit them, you're like, alright, next.
And let's not forget about the real surprise for a Wii U exclusive, Bayonetta 2 is going to be for that system.
By the way, I love you the way you said that. Bayonetta. But, I mean, that's great for them to get that. But, and you know, I think it'll do pretty well, especially because it's a very Japanese game.
Mm-hmm. And the other part of the Wii U we should talk about is basically Nintendo's internet plan. Because as we all know, Nintendo has never really been that good with internet and online play. The Wii was shackled with friend codes, for example.
And you know the rumor about friend codes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That they said that they made the system difficult so pedophiles won't prey on children. Crazy, right?
Yeah.
But they can't survive in the future without a robust, scalable online system like Xbox Live and PSN Network.
Yeah. I mean,
they need to compete, you know?
I mean, Monster Hunter Tri for the Nintendo Wii was a really great game. Probably one of the best online games for the console. But once again, it was just such a pain in the ass to get online and find your friends. Because it was once again shackled by their online policy. And not only that, but Nintendo's online policy also affects indie developers. They have a strict cap on, I guess, how big games could be. And
I know.
And this screwed getting Super Meat Boy onto the console. And I believe they also had harsher regulations on, I guess, violence or disturbing images, because that also prevented the Binding of Isaac from getting on the console.
It's really difficult. They really dropped the ball on WiiWare. Because I had some friends that tried to get into the program, were completely denied, and they made a lot of different, definitely incredible games. But the process to go through it was so arduous and so costly to them that they couldn't continue with it. So it's, you're supposed to make it easy, an easy process to get indies to go in. You don't make it as difficult as possible for them to enter WiiWare stuff. Because what happens is, at least what I see, is a lot of the stuff on WiiWare is just a lot of shovel titles by bigger companies and companies are related to bigger companies, you know what I mean? For producing stuff for it. And that is upsetting because they really missed a chance to get some very interesting independent games that uses the Wii controls.
Yeah. And the indie market has definitely grown in the last few years thanks to Steam and now thanks to crowdfunding like Kickstarter and Indiegogo.
I would say the crowdsourcing, the democratized funding, I think that is a great thing. Mm-hmm. However, I have not seen the, you know, direct impact yet because it's so new.
Yeah. We've seen, you know, a lot of companies make a lot of money, like Double Fine, Project Eternity, and recently Star Citizen, but we haven't seen actual fruit of those labors yet. And I think that's going to be the real test, when these games that have earned millions of dollars are finally released, and we can see definitively or not if it was really worth it.
Right. If this really is a new method of funding your projects, if it's a viable method of funding your projects.
True.
And we'll see. Because right now, all we see are two things. One, like, actually three things. One, a big name comes in, and that pulls all the drunk money to your Kickstarter. Two, you put the word zombie in front of it, and that grabs all the money to it. Or three, you're just lucky. You have good connections, good marketing. You know, you got a lucky news story and everyone's checking it out.
Because
making a good game isn't enough.
It's a marketing plan as well.
Definitely.
I mean, if you don't have the marketing chops or the plan of attack, you just, you know, say, I want to make a game, give me money, no one's going to give you 2 cents.
Yeah, I hear a lot of people just say, like, oh, we'll just do a Kickstarter of it. It's like, One does not simply make a Kickstarter. It is a lot of things that you have to go through and think about what you're going to offer, what your long-term goals are, who your audience is, how are you going to get the Kickstarter out. You can't just make a page and assume it's going to be awesome. Like how people, like when they make a website, they're like, oh, well, I'll just make a website and everyone's going to check it out. It's like, no, you have to get it out there. You need to create links and people need to check it out. You have to actively go out and look for sources that are familiar or helpful to your cause.
True. Okay. Now, for our next part, we're going to talk about some of the games that we've been playing this week. For me, personally, I've been playing Torchlight 2. I finally got it thanks to the big Steam Black Friday sale.
How much did you get it for, by the way? Was it 10?
Yeah, $10. And I've been enjoying it, but I'm really interested in comparing Torchlight 2 to Diablo 3, because both are very similar in design, but there's just very subtle differences in their mechanics. For one thing, Diablo 3 features very well-defined classes. And this is one part due to Blizzard's philosophy on world design, and just their actual design of these classes. I mean, when you see a witch doctor, you understand that, you know, you don't need to question why they summon zombie bears or, you know, plague of toads. That's just, you know, how this character looks and reacts. But with Torchlight, we have four classes, and while they're not, I wouldn't say they're, like, blank scripts or anything, but they don't have that, I guess, pop that you have when you see a Diablo 3 class. But on the other side of it, the problem with having such defined classes in Diablo 3 is that there isn't any real room to get creative. Because everything deals with set skill levels and abilities, it means that you're going to see, you know, a lot of Witch Doctors play the same way or Flavor of the Month builds. But with Torchlight, they have a more open skill system. You have three skill trees for each class, and you put a point into, you know, the skills you want. But each skill has what's called a tier system, tier 1, 2, and 3. When you put enough points into said skill, it unlocks that tier, which gives the skill either a new ability, increases in functionality, just basically makes it better. And what this does is it allows the player to either create more of a jack-of-all-trades character, going, you know, a lot of lower-tier skills, or specialize and say, I'm only going to use, you know, two or three skills, but I'm going to get them up to tier 3, which is the maximum. And this kind of discussion, I'm also going to write a blog post about this sometime next week with a deeper look. Because the part that I find interesting was when Diablo 3 was in beta, I got into the beta around February, I believe. And I loved it. I was ready to, you know, say that this is going to be my 2012 game of the year. How could this game go wrong?
And then how it could go wrong.
Yeah. And after playing the full version, I mean, I was just so disheartened with it. It's like really my most disappointing game of the year. Hmm. And I think a lot of us are just wondering, how did Blizzard drop the ball so hard for this game? And part of that is the loot system, the whole auction house, which I haven't heard anyone actually say, you know, they love that system.
Well, it got achievement in the game, because now you're just gold farming, and then buying things as an update. Because when I was playing through with my friends, we would just take breaks after a few hours, and then just check out the shops, and then come back. So, that's pretty much it. I mean, the other games, it's always about just, you know, hoping for awesome loot to drop and use it. But here's about how much money can we get, what awesome thing will be at the shop itself, at the marketplace.
Yeah. And truth be told, I actually earned some money from the Diablo 3 auction house. I made about $110, so I basically got my collector's edition for free.
Listen, I remember you continuously being on Diablo 3 is like, I'm farming this. Was that worth all your wasted time?
Yes and no. Once I got, it was worth it in the beginning because the game was so, like, ridiculously imbalanced for Inferno that people were spending lots of money. But then, of course, when they made it easier and they raised all, like, the loot drops and the statistics, that just basically wiped out everything that I farmed. So at that point, I just threw my hands up and said, I'm out. And I've been, I guess, casually looking at it again, just seeing what they've done. I know they've added in, you know, new endgame content, like boss, super boss farming.
Super boss farming. Hopefully they didn't not call it super boss farming.
Which, it sounds like it could give some legs to it, but I'm just still so horrifically burnt out on it at this point. And with Torchlight 2, I like it, but I'm not loving it. I thought after Diablo 3 that Torchlight 2 would be this complete breath of fresh air, but I'm finding it lacking in some areas as well. One of the things that I really liked about Diablo 3 is, I guess, the fidelity of combat. There was this, I guess, ebb and flow to the combat in Diablo 3. Like, it wasn't just, you know, you meet a group of enemies and lots of, you know, special effects line the screen. You could move around. You could, you know, set up powers for the skills you use. So it basically required a little bit more of a tactical thought. in Torchlight, basically I run into a group of enemies, I get blinded by, you know, all these different special effects, and I die.
I don't really have that kind of problem with, you know, the visual flares of it. Mm-hmm. In other games like, say, Guild Wars 2, there's some major problems with that. Because when you're, example, if you're fighting one monster, mm-hmm. you might have, like, the fire effect go off. But let's say you have, I don't know, 40 people with the same fire effect. Gigantic monster of flame. So, I mean, that is, I'm not sure if they fixed that or found a solution, but they're looking into it, but you know, that was always a problem, particle effect mania. And I think in this kind of game, when you're having a spell or whatever affect a bunch of characters, you need some sort of visual feedback. It's, mm-hmm. you know, a requirement. If you didn't have that kind of feedback, it wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't know that you're being effective. Mm-hmm. However, if you're confused by it or if it's masking the animations, I think that is a major flaw. But I think you have to show an example of it.
Yeah, I'm going to see if I can capture a few screenshots of that for the post next week. And if the other major part that I think Torchlight 2 stumbles a bit is with the boss designs. If, for those of you who haven't played in Torchlight 2, each boss basically takes place in an arena battle with, you know, a large circular room, and the boss basically can summon infinitely respawning enemies to the fight. So it's never like a one-on-one fight. Just, you know.
Are you sure that's the same way with all the bosses? Because I only fought one like that.
I'm up to, I believe, halfway to almost on Act 2, and every boss has been that way. That they just keep having these random enemies, you know, come in and, you know, distract you or attack you with that. Mm. And I think it just really messes with the fight.
I ran around in circles for like an hour for that fight. What happens, he kept spawning these guys with shields, and I couldn't kill them mm-hmm. before he would come and trample over me. Because mm-hmm. I ended up having zero health potion just running around with my little heal bot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Torchlight 2 is such a big difference from Diablo 3, where each boss was basically its own specifically designed encounter. I found, like, the Butcher fight, the first boss, was just a very interesting and designed fight, because it was more about movement than, you know, just standing there playing two guys hit each other for 10 minutes.
They brought in an environment, and the environment was actually very dangerous. Mm-hmm. It was kind of sad. I was thinking about the leading up to that fight. Mm-hmm. There was, like, a lot of environmental hazards, such as, like, the giant swinging swords mm-hmm. and the fire. But if you stood at the swords, they didn't really do much damage. I wish they would have made all those traps super lethal. Like, if you were to sit there or get hit by a sword, like, you'd lose, like, 9% of your health or something.
Yeah, only the fire pits really did a lot of damage.
And that was only during the boss fight, wasn't it?
When you play on, like, Inferno and the super high difficulties, those things really do hurt like hell.
Yeah, I want it to be, no matter what scenario, be super dangerous, because if a giant axe hits you in the face, you should feel it. And say, I don't want to do this again, I'm going to avoid it best I can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not only was the Butcher fight, but even like the mini bosses and just like the general counters, I mean, they really felt like epic battles. In Torchlight 2, it just feels like, you know, like really it's just like a palette swap of a few different skills for each boss fight so far.
I end up getting pushed around a lot too. When I start trying to hit them, they just push me off. I'm like, oh, okay. But you know, I think that you need to play a little bit more and see some more of the other boss fights before you have a final say on it. Mm-hmm. Because you're only in Act 2. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of more content that goes on and maybe more time spent on certain bosses. However, if they did, however, do a palette swap for all the bosses, that would be a great change.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what game have you been playing this week?
Well, I've been dabbling in the adventure game genre. I played The Walking Dead Episode 5, which is, I believe it's called No Time Left, and another game called Yesterday, which is another adventure game. So first I'll just talk about Walking Dead Episode 5. We both played it. Mm-hmm. I thought, you said it was a little long in the tooth in the beginning, but I thought it was an excellent episode. I think it was a great cap to the whole series.
Yeah, the story really was good. I really liked how what you did in episode 4 and 5 really I guess, were cohesive together. It felt like what you did in the previous chapter really did have an impact. And that was something that I felt was somewhat lost between the previous three episodes, where it felt like more or less that you were being guided by the designer's hand more than your actual choices.
Well, you made some pretty harsh choices in episode 5 right away.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to spoil anything, but there's one choice you make in the very, very beginning that will affect how your main character, like, moves and reacts from then on.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those oh my god choices when you saw what happened there.
Exactly. And I think that shock is what made it really good, because a lot of the choices weren't, you know, binary game choices of good and bad. Mm-hmm. It's about what would you do for survival? Would you do what you need to do? Will lose your humanity?
Mm-hmm. And the fact that who you're with in episode 5 is determined by episode 4. You normally, and for those of you who don't play The Walking Dead, at the end of each chapter, there's a breakdown of what your choices are and what other people did. And normally, this is just a one-page breakdown. But for episode 4, there's actually a second page. And this second page show the choices of how many of the survivors with the main character would join him for the final chapter. And this had a huge effect on how the story played out and the fate of certain people for that final episode. And I am really curious, because it showed that there's a way to basically piss everyone off so it's just you at the end. I'm curious to see just how different that is compared to having the full group of people with you.
Yeah, I think I had most of them. I believe Kenny was like, "Hey man, you didn't try hard enough." I'm like, "Okay, Kenny." It's like, you didn't watch out my, I helped him so much, and he still was like, "Nope, not good enough. I'm not joining you." I'm like, "Kenny."
And I know that yesterday has, from reading general reviews, I know it's not as favorable as The Walking Dead.
Oh no, it is, it's that, yeah, it's definitely not comparable. It's comparable, but it did not do anything to the service of yesterday. Mm-hmm. But let's go on the topic of yesterday then. So yesterday is an adventure game by Pandula Studios. They're a company located in Spain. And I believe a lot of the stuff might be something that's lost in translation from Spanish to English. Mm-hmm. Because it is a very interesting concept. It's an adventure game having to do with, you know, like devil sex, like not devil sex, but no, devil sections. And, immortality, a cult of flesh, a murderer who's killing bums and setting their bodies on fire, a person who has no memory, working for a huge company. It has a lot of interesting pieces to it and mystery, but they really dropped the ball by two things. One, I think it's something that can't help, because the problem of budget wasn't probably that large, was the animation. Cause, in the game description, their animation was described as, you know, full motion, extremely cinematic, movie quality. I'm like, alright, I'm here now to be impressed.
Mm-hmm.
And when they showed it to me, they have like a comic motif, so panels will pop open for people's faces to talk.
Oh, God.
And they would just stare at you. The two panels next to each other, it would just stare at you, and people would talk to you with only their mouths. Their eyebrows, nothing else would move.
Oh, I hate that.
Yeah, it's like equivalent to Fallout 1, too, which is... I think they were better than this one.
Yeah. But, yep.
And the voice acting, too, did not help at all. It was all like, "I don't remember anything. Who am I?" I'm like, "I need to check this out right now." I'm like, oh, man. Oh. They're like, they did not spend any money on this voice actor for it. It was just very, very bad.
Yeah, no. When looking at animations like that just kills me about narrative-rich games. when conversations are just two characters, you know, staring with doll eyes at each other, not moving.
Well, no. First of all, they're not even staring at each other. They're just staring at me. And another thing, too, with their animation is that there were sequences when it was still frames, just still frames. And they would just put them in sequence, and they're like, at the end, they're like, and this is what happened. I'm like, you cheap bastards.
It's funny that one of my favorite games for cinematography have always been the Metal Gear series. Hiro Kojima always had an interest in, basically, in film and doing that cinematography. So what ends up happening is that the characters during the cutscenes, they actually move around. It's actually like watching two people interacting with each other, as opposed to, you know, just, you know, the blank stares or the as Kenneth said, just two guys, you know, staring at the screen talking to you kind of thing.
Well, even though they did a great job with their cinematics in terms of how they did the framing and how they modeled it, I think these Japanese gamers and, I mean, these developers have lost their way on focusing on the cinematic quality of games over, you know, gameplay and narrative. Like, look at Final Fantasy 13.
Oh.
It's just, in 14, oh my god, 14. Like, 13 people are debating, like, oh, it's good, it's so bad. And most of it's bad. But 14, that MMO is so god-awful. Especially, I mean, I'm talking about before the V2, the World Reborn thing. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the original game, when it came out.
Yeah. Wasn't the game so bad that they actually turned off the subscription for like a year or two?
They fired their entire development team and hired a whole new set. That's how bad it was. Let me just tell you two things about that game. I know we're kind of a little off subject, but first, every single mission, first of all, there's no voiceovers. That's already hard, but you have walls and walls of text. And every mission, only goal was complete a stupid mission to get a cutscene. Everything was, if you look at a walkthrough, how to progress in that game in terms of levels, you have to do like blah 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 cutscene, blah 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 cutscene. But it's so brutal because it's no voice acting, it's just the text, and the animation it's in the framing wasn't very good either. It was just poorly done. I felt like maybe some of the beginning cinematics were okay, but then when it got down to just like the in-game, your in-game cinematics, it pales in comparison to things like Knights of the Old Republic and Guild Wars. In Guild Wars, just two people just standing each other talking and animating. It looked great. It's good enough for me. And it really conveyed emotion, while these were just like, you can't skip them and they're horrible.
And
go ahead.
Did they actually turn the subscription back on yet? Or is it not out?
I think they did it by now.
Okay.
Actually, maybe you should put in a link to one of my favorite, I believe they're called Yogscast. They did before they got really popular, they did a review on Final Fantasy 14. And they have one video where, I guess Simon is reading the walkthrough. Mm-hmm. And he's just saying, blah blah blah, cutscene, blah blah blah, cutscene. And then his co-host, is just like, I think Lewis was just screaming. In the background. I thought that was like one of my favorite moments. And it was probably one of the worst experiences. You know what? I'm saying it right now. Final Fantasy XIV, worst game launch of all time. One of the most disappointing games of all time. Right there. For sure. In fact, I believe in the future, I believe that, you know, schools that offer a game design program should look at that as a case study of what not to do when launching your game and making an MMO. But back to yesterday. So animation was really bad. And it was another, again, the second part, the reason it's even worse is that it's so stuck in the adventure game quandary, where you have to find two items to unlock something. Like, you know, two items create a key, or two items unlock this, or two items do this.
It's never, you know, logical.
It's never logical. What I had to do continuously is like, there's a hint system at the bottom of the screen, and you'd have to just look at things or mistakenly put things together continuously for it to fill up, and then you could click it, and I used that the entire game. That's all I did. It was like, I have no idea what to do. Mistake, all right, I'll do this now.
Oh, man. That takes me back to when I was playing Yuru Mess, and
I remember that game.
System that you go, you have to alt tab out of the game, go to a website, and says, give me a little hint. That doesn't work. Give me a bigger hint. I still don't know. Give me a bigger hint. All right, just tell me. I'm completely lost. And, of course, I had no idea about all those puzzles. Like, okay, I don't know. Just give me the freaking solution already, please.
It's driving, yeah, it drives me crazy. That's why, again, when you compare it to Walking Dead, like, maybe I'm jaded because I thought The Walking Dead was an excellent game. And everything, your choices there, made sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Here, it just seemed like they were delaying you
mm-hmm.
and confusing you. Like, okay, so here's an example of one of the puzzles. You're in a train station. You need to make a call. There's a phone that's busted. You have to like, get a toy phone, break it down, take its batteries, use the receiver, and then connect it with a keyboard which replicates dial tones. Which that you can then use to call somebody, but you need a quarter, which is a logic machine that can only be unplugged by another coin. So it just like this goes on with just, it's just asinine, the whole thing. And yeah, I think that was another problem. Like they're like, all right, we do adventure games. Let's go all over. Let's not try to, think through it logistically.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not gonna rag entirely on the game. Two things that I loved about the game, and love is kind of a strong word, but two things I liked about the game. One, it had great soundtrack. Whoever created the soundtrack, fantastic composer.
Mm-hmm.
It had a very memorable theme in it. At least when I hear the song. And it ties some of the characters together. I really loved the 2D art. It was very good. It actually was the reason it compelled me to purchase the game when it was on sale. Because the art was very good, the music seemed pretty interesting. But, the characters didn't fit, the animation was bad, it was very short, it's shorter than the episode of Walking Dead, and this is it cost $30.
Oh my god.
So you would expect it to be $30 or $40, that's crazy, right?
Yeah,
I think I got it on sale for like 7.
Yeah. In The Walking Dead, it's only, was it normally $20 or $14 for this season?
Yeah, the whole season. That's amazing. And I think they're probably one of the only companies that successfully make profit off episodic gaming.
Mm-hmm.
And they got under science.
They've been doing episodic gameplay. I know they first started with
Sam Max, right?
No, their first one was Bone, the comic strip Bone, I believe.
Oh.
Now, they were planning on making that episode, but I don't think it caught as well. They only did like one or two of that. And then their first big hit was when they got the Sam and Max license. And then that basically took off. They've done 3 seasons of Sam and Max, and then they went to, Secret of Monkey Island, Back to the Future.
Back to the Future was pretty good. I like that one.
It was alright. I think it was just such a blast, being in that universe again after the movies.
Right. It still was very adventure gamey though.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I think what most people say is like the worst thing from Telltale was Jurassic Park. I've just heard so many negative reviews about that.
Well, don't forget, I remember on Reddit they went in crazy because they used the Jeep, some guy's Jeep that was Jurassic Park themed, and they came back with scratches and they never got an apology. So they're all up in arms about that, I remember that. But Telltale though, have definitely redeemed themselves with Walking Dead, and I'm really excited to see episode 2. I was actually watching, earlier, a bunch of videos reactions to the ending. I'm watching these Let's Play people cry, I'm like, you get it.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was younger, a professor asked me, can games ever incite emotion? And he said no. I'm like, are you serious? I think it's a very subjective question. Mm-hmm. And here, it's clear that they have crafted such a brilliant narrative and such believable characters that you really feel for them. And it really did push me to an emotional core there. Yep. Not many games can do that. Cause I am so jaded.
Yeah, me too at this point. And I was just telling you before we started, I played the game To the Moon last week too, mm-hmm. which is another adventure game. And I'll admit, I actually cried a few times playing that game.
Wow, and it's 8-bit too, so there you go.
Yeah, and there's only been a few games that made me cry, and To the Moon and The Walking Dead Episode 5 belong on that very short list.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's definitely, I think Walking Dead might be the only one that really, that nearly made me cry.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what we also like to talk about on the Perceptive Podcast is a deeper look at one of our posts on game design. And for this week, we're going to talk about co-op horror. This was a post that I put up last week, which we'll have a link to it in the podcast. Now, Kenneth and I are both fans of survival horror, and we both also feel somewhat dismayed at what has become of mainstream horror, with games like Resident Evil 6 and previews of Dead Space 3 that are moving more towards what people have dubbed action horror. And what that is...
Action horror.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I know, it's weird. And what's going on is, instead of basically making these games scary, they're forcing co-op in these games, either by having, you know, built entirely around co-op, or having, you know, drop-in, drop-out multiplayer. And the problem with that, and what I talked about in my post on Alpha Hero Design, is that when we look at horror movies, there are two types of protagonists. There are what's called alpha heroes and survivors. Alpha heroes are those that are, you know, the one man or woman army. They must, you know, fight the forces of evil by themselves. These are characters like Ash from Evil Dead or Ripley from Aliens. While survivors are people who are just normal men and women who are more concerned with avoiding the bad guys or just escaping. And are generally weaker and really don't have the talent or military training to deal with this.
Well, you know what, actually? You talk about Ripley from Aliens. I think Ripley fits more in the second cat than the first one, don't you think? Because mm-hmm. Ripley, they weren't military. They were just miners. That's why they were so utterly destroyed by these creatures. They didn't have the training to do and take care of these things. And Ripley was, you know, for the most part, mm-hmm. doing everything she could just to survive.
Yeah.
She wasn't running and gunning or anything. She was just trying to hide and escape.
Mm-hmm. And there's, of course, a scene where she basically fights, like, the lead alien.
That's the tip of madness, right?
Yeah. And what ends up happening in horror games is most horror titles are built around the alpha hero because games are more about action. But the problem is that the point of the alpha hero is that it's about isolation. You're not supposed to have a group of people. You can't have four or five alpha cadavers running around because it won't really be scary. And what we're seeing is that mainstream horror designers are ignoring that with Resident Evil 6 and Dead Space. And I know Kenneth was telling me earlier about what they were talking about with who Isaac's co-op partner is going to be in Dead Space 3.
Yeah, again, a big mistake. Not only are you bringing in a co-op partner, but you're bringing a macho, like, loudmouth, trash-talking military type. That's your partner. That's going to make it a lot less scary, right?
Mm-hmm. And you're fighting humans as well as the monsters of the series, which are called necromorphs.
Yeah, but you're also fighting humans now, too, and also using a cover system.
Because cover systems make everything scary.
it just doesn't... Look at this and look at Dead Space 1. They're entirely separate games now. I mean, in the first one, he didn't even speak. In the last, in this one, he talks, he cracks jokes with this military guy. They're solving puzzles together. I'm like, oh man. And they said, like, I think they understand the fear that everyone's having and the hate that everyone's having about the secondary character. They're saying you can play it alone and you just meet him randomly here and there. I'm like, oh. Okay.
So either be a game that requires co-op, or it's just going to be like a half-assed co-op system, from what it sounds like.
Yep, and it looks like, you know, talking about Dead Space, that if they don't sell enough, that the franchise itself will be axed. What was the number?
According to a news piece from a few months ago, EA is demanding at least 5 million copies sold for them to consider the series viable.
Are you serious?
Mm-hmm.
Is that why they put? Maybe that's why they're making it more shooter friendly.
Yeah, and what I still think co-op can work in horror design, just not with alpha characters. And one of the big examples recently of how that worked is the DayZ mod for the game Arma 2. Now, Arma 2 by itself, for those that didn't play it, is a hyper-realistic military shooter. It's all, you know, slow pace, very accurate shots and kill.
By the way, I played that game by itself once, and immediately, as soon as I was, first of all, I was playing with, like, NPCs by myself, and as soon as I stepped up, I got shot in the head and died. I'm like, well, that sucks. And I was like, I quit game now.
And what the DayZ mod is that basically it's a conversion of Arma 2 that takes all those systems, all that realism and military-type gameplay, and puts the players into the zombie apocalypse. So now you're running around with limited ammo, have to worry about food and health, while the undead are scavenging around wanting to kill you. And on top of that, it also features open PvP. So at any moment, you don't know if someone's going to, you know, kill you and take your stuff, or your best friend's going to wait for you to turn around and literally stab you in the back and take your supplies.
As I said, my favorite story from DayZ is once these two players got into a brand new game, and a bunch of guys on a truck came by them and said, "Hey, come to our camp, check it out." And they're like, "All right, sweet, we'll give you some supplies." And, you know, they talk, and they get to the camp. And as soon as the two walk in, they close the doors behind them. And they're like, "If you want to survive, you must fight to the death." And they give them both knives. The winner joins our group. Oh. I'm like, whoa.
It's just got real in there.
It's got real, indeed. But that kind of stories is great. So when a game created that kind of stories, you know, you have a successful mod there.
Yeah. And that's something I would really like to have seen Left 4 Dead evolve to. The original one had such a great mood and theme.
Oh, yes. I loved Left 4 Dead 1, like, theme. I mean, they really stuck to, you know, the film motifs, the B-films, mm-hmm. all those different, and just in terms of environments and just stereotypes that you would see. And they really did create engaging characters. And they did have, you know, an interesting story. You got tidbits as you would walk, because they would speak mm-hmm. at random moments of things.
And that intro, the actual intro to Left 4 Dead, that was just one of the best things I've ever seen. I mean, after I saw that, I basically pre-ordered the game right then and there.
I played the first two levels all the time. Like, I would play it nonstop before the game came out.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us really expected that kind of theme, that kind of setting to translate into Left 4 Dead 2, and they just went like the complete opposite direction.
No, they were just like, alright, let's put in daylight, let's make them southern, let's make a character that's the most bland thing in the world, Rochelle. No one wants to be Rochelle.
Everyone wants to be either Nick or Ellis.
Yes. Exactly. I mean, the original Left 4 Dead characters. Listen, if you're gonna trump Left 4 Dead and go for a quick money grab, keep the characters at least, because they're excellent. Mm-hmm. Who doesn't love any? I love them all. I love them all. Yeah. They all have their own different perks, and their comic series is pretty cool too.
Mm-hmm. And I would just love to see like an almost like an open world, like maybe more grounded version of Left 4 Dead. Just like give me a city, three friends, and say, okay, survive, get out of the city by working together.
Hmm. Pretty interesting to have like a game where you would have multiple groups spawn mm-hmm. in an environment and they can have like make their own forts and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now one other thing with horror, it definitely seems that mainstream horror is slipping and that the indie developers have been, you know, stepping up. We have Amnesia, The Dark Descent, Lone Survivor, Slender, of course. So, I mean, is horror dead, do you think? Do you think that mainstream horror is on its way out?
No. I believe that, you know, what we're really... I mean, what's happening is when there's demand for... When a game has not come out in a while, mm-hmm. something's going to fill the void. Either a main publisher or an indie developer. In this case, indie developers are taking that spot. That they're keeping the genre alive. Mm-hmm. We just notice, here's a theme. With Amnesia, The Dark Descent, and Slender, they're both first person, which creates a whole vision of disorientation, which I think is definitely a benefit to horror, because mm-hmm. you aren't able to see everything around you, hence it already gives you anxiety. So putting you in an environment with low light and mystery, and being able to attack, like Amnesia, you know, that really gives you fear because you can't defend yourself other than using your wits of escape.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of, I guess, getting the view away from the player was a major part of early horror titles when you had the fixed camera angles in games like Resident Evil, Silent Hill, and even some like the lesser known titles like Hunting Ground and Rule of Rose did that.
Yeah, Rule of Rose had a great aesthetic. Great mm-hmm. theme. Just the gameplay was kind of poopy.
Yeah. It was just like very lackluster horror. It was like the old school, you know, go into this room. There's a key. Oh no, the door locked behind you. Now what? Oh look, the enemies are coming out of the walls. You need to fight them with a butter knife.
I wish they had that voice when they're playing the game. Like, what now? What are you going to do? I don't know.
Oh, no. And there, of course, you had the complete classical music arrangement every time there was a fight.
That sounds pretty cool, actually.
Yeah. It gave me a headache, though, when I played it. Like, one, like, the second to last chapters is just, like, 40-minute, like, combat section. And that music was just so repetitive. I started to feel like my head going to explode from hearing, like, the same, like, five or six notes over and over again.
They're putting you in the mind of the protagonist there. She's also going crazy.
Yeah. And I guess with a lot of good horror, you definitely need to take some of that control away from the player. There has to be enough control that the player doesn't feel like they're fighting, like the camera or the controls. But at the same time, you can't let the player see and know everything that's going to happen, because half the horror is the unknown.
And you also have to have the motivation of survival. That needs to be there too.
Yeah. And that's what we saw in Daisy, as well as titles like Slender and Amnesia, that you're stuck in these situations that no one's going to come and get you out of it. It's either you're going to, you know, crawl inch by inch, barely survive, or you're dead.
Exactly. And that creates great fear when you don't have the ability to run and gun this. Cause again, you could make a game less scary. Like again, like when you go into a movie, you have a suspension of disbelief, right?
Mm-hmm.
Same thing comes with games. If you're going into a horror game without, you know, saying, impress me, scare me, you're not gonna get scared, right?
Yeah.
Usually players like that like just run through everything and that breaks some of the elements and just die.
Yeah. And
go ahead.
When you have like when it's the same thing every time, that's another thing that just kills horror in these types of games. like in Dead Space 2, one of the things they were, I guess, but proud of was the AI was supposed to, you know, track you and follow you around. But all it was them just, you know, walking around, and you could just stay in one spot and just shoot them as they pop around the corner.
Mm. Well, yeah, that's a major flaw for sure.
Mm-hmm. I still say that my personal favorite horror game, at least for the consoles, was Fatal Frame 3. That was just one of the scariest games. That game scared the fear out of me.
Wait, didn't that make you fear less then?
No, after that, nothing else was scary.
Exactly. So, I would say we should probably start wrapping up the conversation.
All right.
As also the Skype chat is breaking down. That's why.
All right. And I think that will just about do it for this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Join us next week. We'll be talking more about the industry and about game design. Once again, I'm Josh Weiser.
I'm Kenneth Thome.
And have a good night. And remember, we are looking for guest submissions and guests for the podcast. And if you're interested, feel free to send us an email.
And like us on Facebook.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.